Hi, I'm Mike Sklenz, and this is Nintendo World Report's Connectivity Podcast, episode 141, The Yua Died Years Ago. Well, I got two segments and a bonus for you this week. First up, Alex, Josh, and Scott talk about some games they've been playing, and then they do a listener mail segment. And after that, Johnny Metz joins Zach to talk about Godzilla. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this segment of Connectivity. I am Scott Thompson. Today, I'm with Alex Kalafi.
Hey, everybody.
And Josh Max.
Oh, it's good to be back.
It's been a while.
It's been months. A while for me.
Decades. Does anyone ever call you Joshua?
No. No. No one ever does.
Not even your parents or anything?
Why would they? The Yua died years ago. I buried it in a ditch.
Did that happen, like, steadily, or was it just, like, at some point you were an adult and the Yua was gone?
No one really called me Joshua. It's not really, it sounds, I don't know, I always thought it sounded more, like, religious than it needed to be.
It does. I mean, I definitely can see that. It has religious roots, that's for sure.
Yeah. He took over for Moses.
Yeah, that's right. Big shot. So we're going to be talking about our names today on Connectivity. So we are going to be talking about a few games that we've been playing, some new, some old, that we just haven't really talked about recently, or maybe not at all. And then after that, we've got a bunch of questions from email and Twitter that we're going to go over, some really good questions. So should be pretty fun. But kicking things off, yeah, let's talk about games we've been playing. Who would like to start?
I guess I'll start.
Josh.
Yeah, hi. I'll start.
All right, go ahead, Josh.
Well, I haven't been playing anything new. In fact, I've been playing a lot of old games. Because recently, I got my N64. I dusted it off, brought it to my apartment. And pretty much since the 4th of July, we've been playing it nonstop. And we've been doing Super Smash Brothers, Mario Kart, GoldenEye, Banjo-Kazooie, Mario Parties, Super Mario. We couldn't find any of the Zeldas, so we're actually going out and finding them around the city right now so we can replay them in their N64 glory. But yeah, it's just like, it's like really, you know, headed back to my roots, man.
What do you think of the visuals of these N64 games? Because I've always been of the opinion that this particular generation has some games that have almost become unplayable because of how rough the polygonal graphics look.
I don't know, man. I mean, I didn't bring any of my, like, crappy games. Like, I don't have Superman 64 or anything like that.
Right.
But, like, all the games I have are, like, still so good. Like, I played Smash with people last night for, like, 4 hours straight. Like, it's still, like, it holds up. Like, even without, like, the B-overs or anything like that. It's still, like, it's such a good game. And even Mario Kart holds up. Like, they all hold up, like, with graphics and everything. I'm actually still surprised how catchy all the music is.
Have you gotten the Pokemon Stadium games yet?
Yes, I have both of them.
Which one do you prefer?
Two. Although
we had
a conversation about it last night, me and my friends, and it's just, they don't hold up as well as we wish they would.
Yeah.
Because they're just, like, encounters that just take longer than in the game.
Yeah, right.
And it's just like, and the mini games do not hold up as well as I wish they would. But it's still, like, it's still fun, but it's fueled entirely on nostalgia.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, even at the time, the Pokemon Stadium games, it was all about just the spectacle. You know, it was about seeing these little sprites that you've trained for hours and hours and hours, you know, realized on the screen and looking like they look in, you know, in the artwork and in the anime and that kind of stuff.
And if you renamed them like Drillby, then it turned a different color, but only in Stadium. Like, it was like the fake shinies. You're like, oh yeah, I got Drillby. He's the, it's a shiny Beedrill. You probably don't have one. But, like, I have a Game Boy. It's not even color. I don't, sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's a shiny one. I don't know.
I remember just transferring glitch Pokemon over to Pokemon Stadium.
How would that work?
Well, because it has the Game Boy adapter, and you can actually transfer Pokemon from your game, I think one way, into Pokemon
you can do it
Stadium.
Both. I actually still have that adapter, and I did that. I still have my old Pokemon Red and Blue. You can transfer them in and out.
Okay, cool. So
I've transferred one out.
That sounds better than I imagined. But there are these glitch Pokemon, missing no an M, but specifically M, which it's that whole Cinnabar Island glitch.
Right.
You can look it up yourself. At level 2, if you catch a level 0-1 and evolve it to level 2, I think, it evolves into a Kangaskhan.
Oh,
but
yeah!
Because M is a bird type, not flying type, but bird type, one of the prototype Pokemon types, you can teach it fly before it evolves. So when it turns into a Kangaskhan and you transfer it into Pokemon Stadium, you can actually teach Kangaskhan fly using that evolution method. So you can actually get a flying Kangaskhan into a Pokemon Stadium. It was just the coolest thing.
Haven't there also been like so many iterations of Pikachu? There's that some Pikachus know fly and some know surf.
Yeah.
I was like, surfing Pikachu was a big thing, yeah.
I don't know why it was a big thing, but it was like, yeah, man, we got this little electric mouse, and if we put it in water, people are going to go ape shit. And indeed we did.
Well, that wasn't a glitch, right?
Wasn't no, that was Pikachu, a promotional. Like,
no, that was promotional.
A promotion, yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
And everyone went crazy.
Surfing Pikachu had cards. There was birthday Pikachu at one point where you wrote the name of the person and it said, this person's
birthday.
Pikachu. There was the flying Pikachu where he had balloons.
And
they even brought surfing Pikachu back for a while back in Pokemon Battle Revolution when if you, I think, beat the game completely, you can actually transfer a Pikachu that knows surf into your Diamond and Pearl game, which was kind of cool, even though it didn't go on a surfboard when it entered the water.
Oh, but I will, you know, speaking of surfing Pikachus, there is one game that holds up, but also, like, because it wasn't that great in the first place, Pokemon Snap.
Ooh,
you could
yeah.
beat that thing in an afternoon, but it's yeah. still so much fun that it's just like, I don't give a shit.
What a creative game that was.
Right?
It was. I mean, I even played through the whole thing again when it came out on the Wii Virtual Console, you know, way back in 2007, maybe. Maybe it was that first full year of the Virtual Console. I don't remember, but... Yeah, no, I mean, it's such a fun little game, and as has always been said since the Wii U's been a thing with the gamepad, like, the fact that there isn't a new Pokemon Snap yet is insane.
I know, it's just, like, it makes so much money, and it's, like, it was such a well-made little game. It's just, like, I don't understand, like, I can understand why they don't make another Pokemon Puzzle League, but I don't understand why they're not making another Pokemon Snap.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like at this point, they could even just, like... Like, I mean, it wouldn't be a true HD remake, but I mean, just like, even if they cleaned up the original for the Wii U using the gamepad, like, even that would be enough for people,
oh,
like,
yeah.
for now. I mean, why not even put that much effort into it, see the success it will undoubtedly have, and then make a new one? It's just crazy.
I don't know, man. Preaching to the choir.
So, just quickly, Josh, out of all of the N64 games you've now replayed, which one is your favorite?
Oh, man, don't do this to me.
Like, you can name a couple.
You're making me pick my favorite children. I don't know. I'm still a huge fan of Smash, but it's because I'm still like that was like one of the essential games I played with all my friends when I was little, and I still will boast that I'm pretty good at it right now. But I mean that Mario Kart 64 and I guess for I like a lot of those multiplayer games, but if I had to choose one, I'd say Banjo-Kazooie's up there.
Mm,
that's a good game.
That's really up there. It's either that or Mario Kart. Oh, wait, no, what the fuck am I talking about? Ocarina of Time. I mean, I don't have it right now, but once I re-get it, I'm going to love it again.
Yeah.
That.
What, kind of going, you said you haven't been playing GoldenEye?
I've been playing a little GoldenEye.
How's that going now that we're so accustomed to, like, when Twin Stick
controls? It's all right.
Stick control,
it's all right. I don't know.
I think there is in Perfect Dark. I don't know if there's in Golden Knight. Isn't there a control scheme where you can use two controllers and kind of emulate the two sticks?
I have never done
that. It might be in Perfect Dark. It might not be in...
I've never played Perfect Dark.
Oh, really?
No.
Perfect Dark's good.
I think it's worth me going around and looking for now. Maybe
yeah,
GameStop will have it.
If you want to play multiplayer in that, you got to get the RAM expansion. I don't know if you have that in your N64, but...
I'm going to say 50-50 shot.
Let's we'll open it. If it's got the red top, then that's the expansion. If it's got the black top, then that's the original.
Oh, it's got a red top.
Okay, then you should be good. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that thing was amazing. The RAM expansion.
Yeah, but... didn't and you needed that for Donkey Kong 64.
You did. You couldn't play any Donkey Kong 64.
Another
Donkey Kong 64.
Top 10 game for me. That was a great game.
That game is bad. My wife and I, we kind of went through a kick where we were going through N64 games again about a year ago. We played through like and mostly racing games. We played through like all of Cruisin' USA, Mario Kart 64, and she had these like fond memories of Donkey Kong 64. So we went to like a used game shop and found it and brought it home. And that game is rough.
No man. Again, it runs on nostalgia. Like that game is so much fun. But just because you're like, hey man, this is where the DK rap comes from. Hey, remember Lanky and Chunky Kong? They were cool. You could walk
like the the knockoff Dixie.
Oh god, Tiny Kong. Yeah, that was a great idea.
Was it Tiny?
I think it was something like that.
Was that her name? It was something. She was like wearing overalls and stuff. Yeah, that was
Tiny Kong was a thing.
I don't know, man. Tiny Kong. It was kind of fun, but at the same time, like you are completely right. It was rough, but like I don't know. I still really enjoy it.
I mean, I made myself play through the whole thing at the time when I was a kid. But yeah, going back to it now. I mean, I knew it was going to be bad, but I wasn't prepared for how bad it was going to be. I mean, it runs at like 4 frames a second.
Yeah.
And just, you have to like, you can't do anything at all. You have to like, you know, have every Kong to do anything. There's like a million things to collect. It's bad.
It takes a while, But like any, but like any difficult child, if you raise it with love, it'll turn into a Sylveon.
And in the very least, you can play the original Donkey Kong in Donkey Kong 64.
That I straight up love. I loved that when I found that.
That's like the best part of the game.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So enough about me. Tell me about you. What are you guys playing?
Well, I'll go next. And, you know, we talked a lot about Mario Kart 8 when, you know, after the reviews went up, the reviews that shook the world. You know, Neil and Don gave it both 7.5, and I don't think we've really talked about the game since then.
We've kind of stepped back a little, not out of fear, but like, let's cool down for a little while.
You know, I don't even know how much it was that. I think a lot of it was just related to just, I mean, I think we've been busy. I mean, E3 was shortly after that, and there's just been a lot of other stuff going on. We haven't really done like a true, just like what we've been playing segment in a long time either. But I've been playing Mario Kart 8, like pretty much nonstop since it's come out. At a point it was every day, and now it's kind of cooled down to like every other day or every few days, but my wife and I will still jump online and race a whole bunch. I pretty much every weekend now, myself and Nicholas Bray, our friend from Australia, fellow staff writer, we'll kind of host like Mario Kart racing nights, usually like every Saturday night or every couple Saturdays or something like that. So follow us on Twitter if you want to get in on those, but I really, really enjoy Mario Kart 8. I'm not going to debate scores or anything like that. I can understand where Don and Neil were coming from. But as far as like playing online with everybody and playing it with my wife too, it's been a lot of fun. It's the first Mario Kart I've really gotten into, I think, since 64.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, like I really liked Double Dash.
What about 3DS?
And, you know, I played, obviously DS was good. I didn't really get into the Wii one very much. And then Mario Kart 7 was also, you know, they were good and I played them, but this is the first one that's like that Mario Kart 64 thing where I am playing it like just constantly.
Well, I'm very interested then in what this game just for you has that games like Mario Kart 7, a very similar game in a lot of ways, didn't do. And like what's making this experience harken back to Mario Kart 64 for you? Is it just the multiplayer that you've been playing with your wife? Is it visuals? Is it just a combination of things?
It looks fantastic. I mean, it's one of the best-looking Wii U games, like, easy. I mean, sometimes I'll kind of just sit back and, like, watch stuff in the background and look at the characters and the way, you know, they'll kind of glisten coming out of water and all these different effects. And, I mean, it looks so good. And I love the music, too. I love this, like, sort of jazzy... like infusion they put into every track. I really love the music, but no, it's for sure the multiplayer. It's the fact that it's so easy now to jump online and just instantly be racing. And I, you know, every now and then I've had a game will drop, but for the most part it's been rock solid and it's just been great. It's just been perfect in that regard, and always having people to play with. It's a little cumbersome with setting up games with people online because you have to be Wii U friends with them, and you can only have 100 Wii U friends, which is a problem for me. So like every weekend when we are doing these online races, I'm like deleting people who I don't maybe necessarily know, or I see who haven't logged in like 3 weeks, to add new people, just because that's how it goes to set up like a custom game with everybody. So that's kind of annoying, but no, it's just this like just fun pure racing experience. I enjoy a lot of the new tracks, and yeah, it's just been great playing with my wife. Now, it's not all that different from Mario Kart 7, maybe, like fundamentally, I guess. But I think being able to play it on the console, play it on the big TV, jump in and out so quickly, I think that's a big thing. So yeah, we're just pretty much hooked.
I've been so close to buying this game. Since
you don't
it
have
came
it?
Out. I don't have it. Well, I took a stand against it for several reasons that you can see in one of my top three or five lists way back. And I've stuck by it, but like that Wii U extra game promotion has been sucking me in. Mm-hmm. And then just the whole zeitgeist of it, how it's like, oh, everyone else is into it. Maybe there's something here I haven't seen. And I have basically until July 27th, until that promotion runs out, ends, at yeah. which point I will never buy Mario Kart 8. So now there has been this weird internal struggle, like, hey, it's 46-something on Amazon today. Maybe yeah. that's not so bad. But since it's come out, I've went to the GameStop and Best Buy. I think it's only been playable at the GameStop. And I've played the Mario Kart 8 demo, I think, 5 times. It's had all the characters unlocked. And I think 8 tracks. So I at least get a good taste of the gameplay and the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So since I've played it 5 times, maybe 25-30 minutes total over those several weeks, I just see Mario Kart. I don't think it's because my heart's turned to dust, but it's I guess I just don't see the same thing that many others do see. I don't see the Nintendo magic at work here. That at least wasn't the same Nintendo magic that was in Mario Kart 7 and Mario Kart Wii.
Well, the magic's there, but yeah, it's maybe not. It's not
new magic.
Any different? Yeah. See, the big thing is going to be how you play it, and I think that's where Neil and Don came from in the reviews. Is they played it strictly as kind of a single player thing. I mean, naturally, they tested the online against other people who were reviewing the game or just happened to have early copies. But it's really the multiplayer experience that's going to make it or break it for you. So, like, if all you're interested in is racing, you know, the Grand Prix, unlocking the meager things there are to unlock, like, yeah, it's going to be more of the same and you're not going to be that into it. But if you really do go online and race a lot and find a group of people to play with consistently, like that's what's going to set this game apart. And the ease of playing online compared to like even something on your 3DS or the Mario Kart Wii. So yeah, if you get into like racing with Nicholas and I every Saturday or doing different things like that, that's where it's really going to shine, because the online infrastructure is just so much better than it was in the past games. So that's really where it is. That's where you're going to have the most fun.
I mean, I'm just saying, I'm this close to buying it as soon as I get a Wii U.
You still don't have one yet.
Dude, I'm telling you, when you're as rich as I am, you're spending so much money on your gold-plated bathroom tiles, you forget about the little things like the Wii U. You know what I mean?
Meager Wii U's.
Meager Wii. I could buy and sell a factory of them. That's how rich I am. No, but seriously, it's just like, I want to pick up a Wii U. I just, you know, I went once I get the funds. I don't know. I'm pretty happy with the 3DS right now. And when I want to play...
Wasn't it... Go ahead.
When I want to play a Wii U, I can generally, like, I have friends who have it, so I'm able to still, like, keep up on Wii U titles.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know, it's just, it hasn't been a priority for me recently. Because the 3DS has been just so good to me so far this year.
I think, didn't Kotaku just name it, like, the first next-gen console worth buying? It was either Joystick or Kotaku. I think it was Kotaku.
I don't know. I'm not going to pretend like I do.
It just went up this week, yeah, or a couple of days ago, an article saying that now is the time to get a Wii U, and it's the first of the big three new consoles that is now a must-buy, so there you go.
I think must-buy. Well, you know what? I'm not going to have that discussion. I think calling the Wii U a must-buy at this point is still maybe going a little bit too far. I think it will be a must-buy in 2015.
In my mind... In 2015,
it's a must buy. That's the thing that's bothering me right now. Must buy. You have to have it.
That's the part I disagree with. It's a little hard to think about because, I mean, Josh doesn't own it, but, you know, Alex, you and I have had it since getting it on the ground floor. So
right.
It's a little hard for me to think about that now. But imagining someone just now buying it, thinking about New Super Mario Brothers U, Mario 3D World, Pikmin, you know, a plethora of, like, indie games, Mario Kart 8. If you bought it now, you would have so much more to do versus Xbox One or PS4.
I mean, the 3DS went through the same thing. Like I bought that day one, and it was the same way with the Wii U. It had the slowest start. But, like, anyone who picks it up now has, like, hundreds of good games, if not great games, to pick from and just to catch up on.
Yeah, and so that's where I could see the Wii U having that advantage. I still don't know that makes it must-own, necessarily. But
I was just talking about in general. I don't think, even though I own a PS4 and you own a PS4, yeah. I still, like, PS4, if you can hold off from that new-gen sheen, you probably should hold off until at least something like Bloodborne comes out. But, sure, out of the three consoles, Wii U has the most games right now.
Right.
But just in general, just as its own little standalone thing, I don't know. I guess that's a segment for another day, but I guess most of the sequels have been a little too sequel-y. I haven't seen what Pikmin 1 was.
Wait, what?
I guess
you never played Pikmin 1?
No, I'm saying it doesn't have a game that... It doesn't have a new franchise on the level of Pikmin.
Oh, okay.
Nearly alongside it. Like, all the new franchises are, like, C plus B minus tier, including Splatoon. All of the sequels are pretty direct sequels to games that came out in, like, the last 5 years, with the exception of Pikmin 3, of course.
Yeah, but for a second I thought you just hadn't played Pikmin, and I was like, this podcast is over, you have homework.
I have a copy about 5 feet away from me.
Hey, me too! Guys, let's all talk about how close Pikmin is to us. Physically.
But it's just, I think Wii U still has some time to go before it gets some super original games, at least, like, hopefully the new Super Smash Bros. And the new Zelda.
Well, that, to me, yeah, if it's not must-own now, I think even by the end of the year, I think with Smash Brothers and Mario Maker, throw those two things in, and now I think you have a must-own system with everything that's already come out in the past 2 years, so...
So it will get to must-own. I think it will get to must-own eventually. I just don't think it's there as of July 10th, 2014, as we're recording this.
Sure. It was just nice to see a positive Wii U story come out of anywhere.
Sure.
So that's where I'm at. Mario Kart 8, a lot of fun. Especially, the multiplayer, like I said, is what's going to do it. And again, if you're out there and want to play Mario Kart 8 on the weekends, late at night with me and Nicholas, I guess it's early in the morning for him, probably. Follow me on Twitter, OKSoda. That's where we kind of announce when we're going to do it. It's usually kind of just sort of happens. So just be paying attention at like 10 o'clock at night on Saturdays.
Hey man,
it's been fun. We've gotten full games the past couple weeks. And it's been pretty good. Nicholas is really good at Mario Kart. So if you can come in and beat him, like, that's what I want. I need Nicholas to be beaten.
I'm just saying, if I get a Wii U, I will be there.
Okay, do it.
So
you can buy the Mario Kart bundle now.
I mean, I'd love to. I'm going to start a Kickstarter for it.
Okay.
Help Josh get a Wii U and Mario Kart so he can attempt to beat everybody in the world at Mario Kart.
You might be able to like spin that because you have to produce something with Kickstarter. So if you promise that you're going to produce like awesome Mario Kart 8 replays to post on Miiverse and YouTube, you might be able to get away with that.
I could promise to humiliate Neil with it.
Perfect.
I can't promise that. I don't know how good he is at Mario Kart 8.
He's pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, let's move on. Alex, what have you been playing?
I've been playing anime games.
Hooray! Yay! Are you excited for the new One Piece game?
So this ties directly into what my summer's been like. So I've been on summer vacation for the last month or so, and while I expected to play a ton of video games with my 3 months, I ended up getting caught up in a lot of manga and anime, which is something that has never happened in my life before. It first started with a boxing manga called Hajime no Ippo. I think I'm pronouncing that at least semi-correctly, which is a fantastic manga and anime about a kid who becomes a boxer. It's been running since like the late 80s, and there's about 1,000 manga chapters, and I ended up reading them all in the span of a few weeks. And then I got hooked, and I'm like, all right, so there's something to this manga thing. I got to see what's next. So then I got into JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. That was fantastic. I started watching Cromartie High, which is an anime comedy, which is extremely funny. And now I've been on to Fist of the North Star, the classic early, mid to late 80s manga and anime, which is this post-apocalyptic story It takes place in this wasteland post-nuclear war. And it's about this guy named Ken who is like Bruce Lee and Superman put together. He uses this assassin martial art kung fu type thing to touch the pressure points of these bandits and make them explode. And it has fantastic villains. It has just fantastic manga action. I would not recommend the anime because it's not that good. And it's basically the inspiration for most of the classic, or at least most of the really popular martial arts type mangas, like the Yu Yu Hakusho's, and at least somewhat JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. They clearly owe a lot of their DNA to at least Fist of the North Star, if not something directly inspired by it. And it's like the fusion of the post-apocalyptic appeal of The Walking Dead with the appeal of, like, a Bruce Lee movie, how it's kind of campy, kind of corny, but you feel totally badass by the end of it. So, I have been playing on PlayStation 3, it's also on Wii U, Fist of the North Star, Ken's Rage 2. And it is a pretty direct translation of the manga in the sense that it takes levels from chapters of the manga. It was made in celebration of the 30th anniversary, and it is basically a Dynasty Warriors game that is a faithful adaptation of this story. And I think, even though you hear Dynasty Warriors, you might go, the appeal to this game is that this is kind of the manga that's made for a Dynasty Warriors game. Like, something big and dumb where you're just blowing up hundreds of enemies at a time. That's kind of exactly the game this thing needs. And in that sense, it's very successful. It's very faithful to the source material. It's clear that the people love the source material. And because of that, they pull it off to a certain extent as a Dynasty Warrior style beat-em-up. Because it has tons of playable characters. It has tons of dream scenarios. And it's pretty much one of the best things you could hope for in an anime game. Except for the fact that the game itself isn't that good. Like, it's specifically, mechanically speaking, it has the same problems of a Dynasty Warriors game where you're killing just a few too many enemies and it gets just a little bit too brainless and it's a little too repetitive. All the enemies kind of look the same. And in that sense, it's kind of boring. It's not a great game. I think I gave it a 4.5 when I originally reviewed it on PS3 like a year and a half ago. Even though it's not that great, even though it's terribly repetitive and it has a lot of filler, which was the biggest problem with the anime. It's like a lot of other anime games where even if the game itself isn't that great, like 90% of anime games are, as long as the people making it have a love for the source material and as long as it's relatively faithful, anime games are weirdly fulfilling in a way few other games are. And Josh, I don't know if you specifically know what I'm talking about.
I do, actually. Very, very much so. The last One Piece game I bought, I don't buy a lot of them, actually. The last one I bought was Pirate Warriors 2, which is a Dynasty Warriors type game for the PS3.
That was on PS3, right?
Yeah. It's really good. I still play it every now and then, since you can play online with other people. It's still really good. Because the first game followed the plot of One Piece to, like, you know, it was like, you know, they didn't want to mess with the people's heads too much. But this time they straight up went, dream story. Like, a story that never happened and will never happen. Where, you know, where people are going to fight alongside each other. It's a whole thing. But it's, you pretty much play as anyone you wanted to play as, in any place you wanted to play as. And there's just, like, tons of stuff, like, that you can keep playing over and over and just level up all your characters. I mean, you could beat it in, like, over, like, 2 or 3 days if you really wanted to. But it's, I don't know, I do know what you're talking about, because it is oddly fulfilling.
And I would, like, I thought about this a lot since I've been playing this for the last few days. Like, why are anime games so weirdly fulfilling? And this is something that I think you can probably only attest to if you've gotten into a manga or anime before and then played a subpar game based on that anime or manga. Like, for me, the first one that I got this feeling with was the original Yu Yu Hakusho game, way back on the GBA, which was a pretty shitty game. I think we might have given it a 3.5 by whoever was on site at the time. but because it was a faithful adaptation, I ended up playing through it like two or three times when I was younger anyways. And that's, I just think about it. And the conclusion I came to is that a good anime game is kind of like a conversation between you and someone else who really, really loves the same thing you do. And it's just a conversation that consists of the game maker saying, hey, remember this part of the anime? Wasn't that so fucking awesome? And then you go, hell yeah, it was so fucking awesome. And then it's just a back and forth as they keep giving you these scenes and you keep experiencing even a subpar playable version of it. It's weirdly fulfilling to feel the things you've been reading and watching come to life in the palm of your hands, even if it's not pulled off flawlessly. And it's a feeling, I'm not saying it's more fulfilling or less fulfilling than any other type of game, but it's a very specific type of feeling that only anime games can deliver. And I think it's worth trying if you've ever had a manga or an anime that you've really gotten into.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I agree with that. I mean, there, like, to an extent, we all kind of felt that when some of us played Pokemon. Because, you know, I know, like, when I was growing up, some people played it solely because of the TV show, and that's how they got into it. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure, can attest to that.
I actually, yeah, I never thought of it that way. Because I always think, like, the game came first, and then the anime happened.
Well, didn't the anime come out first?
I probably watched the show first.
Didn't the show come out first in the U.S.?
In the U.S., maybe. I was just thinking just in general with the franchise, like how it was a game series first. That might be right.
I don't know. All I know is I'm level 15 on Quiz Up on Pokemon, so if anyone wants to fight me in Quiz Up, that new quiz app, I'll take you on. But I don't know. Maybe. It might have come out in the U.S. I don't know. We're getting off topic. What's next, guys?
Well, actually, hold on. Scott, do you have any idea of what Josh and I have been talking about for the last few minutes?
No, not at all.
Have you ever been into a manga or anime at all?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I'm not ashamed to admit that I was pretty into Naruto for a while. I'll admit it.
Hey, we all dabbled. We all dabbled.
And then I've never really gotten into any, like, anime series, but I do like films in anime style, so like
the Miyazaki's,
exactly. I mean, pretty much exclusively that, but I've seen other stuff too, like Ninja Scroll and a variety of other things. But yeah, not too much into series, like TV series, and definitely not manga. I've never read a manga in my life.
Ever want to give One Piece a try, I will talk about it.
There are a lot of good entry-level things. Like, there is, if you want really, really entry-level, there is a lot of Shonen Jump stuff, like the One Piece and the Narutos of the world.
Right.
If you want something
not
classic.
Not the One Pieces. It is just One Piece. And I'm not saying that as, like, a fanboy. I'm saying that, like, it is the, like, highest-selling manga of, like, all time.
But, so there are the Shonen Jumps, which are very accessible to people of all ages. And then there are the classic ones like the Hokuto no Ken, Fist of the North Star, which is surprisingly extremely accessible if you want something that isn't made to accommodate anyone below the age of 13 at all, because it moves super fast and the action is pretty extreme compared to a lot of the more modern stuff. I just think it's so badass. I just think Fist of the North Star is so badass. I've been having a blast reading it. But in general, if you want to try a manga at all ever, there are apps, specifically one called Pocket Manga or Pocket Manga Reader. But just basically look up Manga Reader on the App Store or the Google Play. And you can get these apps where you can read pretty much any manga you want for completely free. And I think it's legal because no one's taken any of this stuff down yet. So if you ever want to read something, just download a simple app and you can read as much as you want on your phone for completely free.
Hmm.
I don't know. It's an amazing world anime and manga is, I've discovered, because it's basically like video games, except you don't have to put effort into playing them.
Yeah.
I don't know. There goes my rambling. I'm done. But I am excited about something this week.
This has been the summer of anime for you. Summer or manga. Manga specifically, I guess.
Sure.
Guys, we'll be opening up a lot here today.
Yeah, we're really getting deep.
Learning more about ourselves, about each other.
Oh my god, guys, this is a breakthrough episode.
To a few listener questions. Like I said, we got these one from email and a few from Twitter. Let's start with the email one. This is from Tim Chatton. He says, "Hello there. During one of the Treehouse Live segments, Reggie went on to discuss his 3DS issue. He was complaining about having to juggle two systems, one from work and his personal system. The segment ended with him joking that he needed a 3DS holster to use both. Am I the only one extremely saddened that this wasn't used to lead up to Reggie announcing some kind of unified account system? I collect 3DSs, so out of my 10 or so systems, I can only really use one at a time. I can only have my Nintendo Network ID used on one 3DS and one Wii U. To swap 3DSs, I have to do system transfers, so I don't swap out systems that often. It seems that Reggie understands the frustration of not being able to more fluidly use more than one system, but just laughs it off instead of doing something about it. It seems that Nintendo would make more hardware money if they encouraged a single owner to own multiple systems instead of the outliers like me that collect them. Would love to hear your thoughts. Was this just Reggie trolling, or is Nintendo just that oblivious? Keep up the good work." My thought is, and I didn't see the specific segment, but to me, a lot of the Treehouse stuff was a little kind of unscripted, a little off the cuff. My thought is this was him just kind of joking around without anything at all behind it.
Yeah, I got the exact same vibe from that. And Reggie especially loves to have a good unscripted joke now and again.
Yeah.
Even though he's probably heavily prepared before every single event, and those unscripted jokes are maybe a little less unscripted than some of us might think, but he does usually like to have a lot of fun, and I think this was him just having fun. However, I do think we are very, very close, maybe not next year, but maybe next few years, to having something very closer to unified systems. And I think in the next 10 years, Nintendo will be up to standard with everyone else. And I'm sorry that I have to say next 10 years, but I'm just trying to be on the safe side.
10 years is quite a bit. But, well, Alex, I mean, I have a Vita, but you would know more about it than me. Can you easily jump from one Vita to the next and have all access to all your stuff?
Vita is surprisingly restricted, even compared to the PlayStation 3. I've never owned two Vitas. I only have the one I got like back in 2012, mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have too much exact experience. But I do know for a fact that to simply change regions, you have to use a completely different memory card, and you have to use basically reset your system just to change region, which is why some people, even though it's region 3, they own two Vitas just so they don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure, like, that shit is locked down. I think it's because of the piracy that was on PSP.
The PSP was like, yeah, like a piracy. I mean, one of those P's might have well been privacy instead of PlayStation. Piracy. Yeah.
I do praise the Vita for having such a good, like, online infrastructure in general. Mm-hmm. That the accounts between the PS4 and PS3 and PS Vita are extremely unified. I think they still have a similar issue to the 3DS, at least in the sense that once you have a Vita, it's hard to use two Vitas at once for the same account.
Yeah. Now, and it sounds like one of his issues is strictly the linking of the Nintendo Network ID. So, and I imagine the Vita is probably more flexible with this, that I bet you could probably still log into your PlayStation Network account on a different Vita Now, that might not give you access to, like, download all your Vita games on now this other Vita without having to do something.
I just think, I'm pretty sure it's one system at once. I could be completely wrong, and I'm sure if I am, someone will tell us.
Yeah.
But I would be surprised if Sony allowed two different systems to download the exact same content at once.
Right. So yeah, I don't see that happening. But if Tim here is talking about, like, well, he's not so much concerned with transferring games between all the systems, but just even having, like, his Nintendo Network ID and having his Mii and all that kind of stuff, his friends list, go from 3DS to 3DS, even if it's not the games themselves, that seems reasonable that you would be able to do that. But yeah, I don't think you can do that. I mean, I know you can't. You can only have it linked to one system. And like you're saying, you'd have to do a system transfer to even, like, log into your Nintendo Network ID on a different 3DS.
Yeah, I think what he wants is probably asking a little bit too much of Nintendo. And I'm saying this because if you could use one account to basically support 10 different systems, I could imagine that there are people who would basically, like, two friends make one 3DS account, and oh boy, we get to use each other's games, and we get to game share extremely easy with no penalties.
Right.
In this perfect world of Tim's, 10 different people able to use one account. Now, I don't know if people would actually go that far, but it seems like it's actually going one step beyond what game sharing used to be on PlayStation 3, where people could sign into other people's accounts and download games without much penalty.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. So it's not something I'm all that worried about, but I play my 3DS, obviously, but I don't own more than one 3DS, and so this isn't really a big issue for me. Now, I know it's too bad we don't have Zach Miller on here. I know he has a few 3DSs that I think he uses, if I'm not mistaken. I think he might still use his regular one, and then he's got his XL too. I'm pretty sure I remember him talking about, because he played Zelda on one and then was going to have to start over or something to play on the other, something like that. But I don't know. It's not something I'm overly worried about, outside of, like, say, replacing lost systems or something like that. I imagine if you lose your Vita, it's probably a lot easier to buy a new Vita and get all your stuff back than it is to get a new 3DS and get all your stuff back. I mean, as we've documented on this show and on Radio Free Nintendo, I mean, it's a long process working with Nintendo to get all your content back, when really all that stuff should just be tied to your account from the get-go. But
sure.
Yeah, I guess in my mind, it is more likely that they'll make a 3DS holster than support letting you, you know, jump from 3DS to 3DS, you know, as you want with your Nintendo Network ID. So.
See, that's what I wanted to talk about. Why are we not talking about the fact that Reggie probably does have a holster like the Old West for two 3DSs? Why are we not imagining Reggie dressed up like a cowboy walking around Nintendo America with two 3DSs, pulling them out and using them like guns?
Yeah.
Also,
I imagine
I would kind
it would
like
have
that.
To be the size of a wrestling belt, though.
I'm okay with that. It's like, well, yeah, why are you trying to dissuade me?
Because he's a businessman.
This isn't going to dissuade me at all. leave me to my images.
Yeah, you should Photoshop that sometime.
If I had the skills and Photoshop, it'd already be done.
Fair enough. Let's move on to the next question. This comes from Yager, I guess. Yager? I guess Yager, because his account is shot of Yager, so assume it's Yager, not like Yager, like the hockey player.
But Yager, like the Titan Killer?
Yeah, there you go. He asks if there's any advantage to owning Game Boy / Game Boy Color originals over virtual console versions on 3DS. You know, I'm not that huge into the emulation scene, even the official emulation scene, you know, supported by Nintendo and other platforms, to really know the difference. But it's what I hear kind of universally is that the emulation on the 3DS is pretty good. I think you have the same aspect ratio. You can stretch it if you want, but I think you can also play with the bars across the side. I think they even have the, right, can't you have, like, the Game Boy, the actual Game Boy, like, border around around the image, like the old, like, gray Game Boy, the brick. I'm pretty sure you can. So I believe the emulation is pretty good in that regard. And I don't think there's really any problem. So, no, I think it's fine. I mean, if you own a Game Boy and just want to collect them, that's fine. But if something's if something's available on the 3DS, virtual console, I don't think there's any problem with playing it on there.
Yeah, most of them, there's a lot of good ports. I mean, I don't think anyone's really complaining about that. But, like, as a guy who, I love my portable games. I love my Game Boys. I've been collecting them. I just get the new one every time a new system comes out. But, like, I don't know. I've heard word, because I don't collect games that I already, like, have beaten 18 times over on my 3DS. Like, I didn't rebuy Wario World. I'm thinking about getting 3, though. Wario World 3 was amazing. But, like, I don't know. Like, I Pokemon Trading Card Game still isn't out there. Wolverine's Revenge isn't still out there. Like, there are a bunch of great Game Boy games that still aren't out there, and it's just, like, you know, those will always hold a place in my heart. But a little part of me is, like, worried that if they ever do, like, there are all these, like, hacks and cheats that, you know, were, like, staples of the game, and I'm afraid they're gonna get, like, taken out, because, you know, sometimes when these games get re-released, some little things that seem insignificant but were really a big part of the game get removed, and it kind of takes away from the experience a little bit. At least for me. I don't know.
Yeah. That's fair. What about you, Alex? Do you have any experience with this?
Well, I think there's certain trade-offs. The trade-off with Game Boy cartridges is that you get to play it as it was originally made, as it was originally sold, with resale value, and you can probably sell it for quite a bit of money. On the other hand, you got the 3DS Virtual Console, where the games look almost as good, with even a few little graphical twists. And the games cost a lot cheaper, and they're a lot more portable than the Game Boy probably ever was. So there is that trade-off. But it's, I think, there's always that slimy emulation third option, where you just download a bunch of ROMs. And in that option, which is always the best solution, just from a monetary standpoint, you can make the games look better. You can play mods that never existed on the original cartridge, like Pokemon Brown.
Oh, God.
And you can actually make the games look better, and you can play them however you want with whatever controls you want on the PC.
You mean like the Pokemon randomizers?
This question is basically a fight between second and third place.
Okay.
And, however, in the fight between second and third place, I think the 3DS is probably a better option to me. But I mean, get real, right? I don't mean that. Not to the person asking the question. Just, I mean, at the end of the day, we all know who the winner is.
Yeah, you know who you are, winner. We don't need to say it.
So, yeah, well, there you go. But if your concern is in terms of the quality of the emulation, I've never had or heard of any big issues with playing Game Boy Color or the original Game Boy on the 3DS Virtual Console. So, yeah, so I wouldn't worry about that. There's been really bad official emulation in the past, but I don't think that's the case here. You know, it's really emulated well on the 3DS, too, are the Game Gear games. You didn't ask about that, but those are really well done on the 3DS, and actually support, like, a few different options, like, more options than the Game Boy and Game Boy Color games. So, look into those, too, if you want to play some of those classic Game Gear games. There aren't many classic Game Gear games, but there's some.
I'm just looking for the Virtual Boy games, man. When are those coming out?
That's a no-brainer.
Those really, what is keeping them?
Wait, are you kidding me?
Like, well, no, I'm just thinking about it, because Virtual Boy emulation does exist, and if, like, some people on, like, the internet can do it, I'm sure Nintendo can.
Yeah, but it was like, there was no reason to play those games aside from shoving your face into infrared.
Well, there's the Wario game, which was supposedly pretty good. Mario, I think it was Clash, at least has the appeal of being a part of history. There's Mario Tennis, there's Nestor's Funky Bowling. There's at least a few games they could release on a Virtual Boy console. Even if they put the work in to make it 3D, that would especially be worthwhile.
I think, and I want this to come out at some point, but I think the success of the Virtual Console has changed a lot over the past, 7 years now? 8 years, God, since 2006 when it launched with the Wii. And I think the sort of lack of new games on Virtual Console and the very conservative approach to Virtual Console kind of suggests that bringing over smaller or even unknown games, importing games like they did on the Wii a few times, isn't really that lucrative for Nintendo, and it really isn't worth the trouble. I mean, the fact that all the games that were supported on the Wii from other consoles, not even Nintendo consoles, none of that has come to the Wii U. You know, we have Game Gear games on the 3DS, but that's it. I think really suggests that putting in this kind of effort just isn't worth it. There's not enough return on it. So while some of the Virtual Boy games might be okay and kind of gimmicky, and people would probably give it a go, at least some people would, I think internally they know it's not worth the trouble. It's not worth spending the time and the money to do it, so they're not going to do it. I really like, I want like a full expose in the Virtual Console at some point, because I think it has really, the focus has changed, and I think that that change in focus suggests that it's not quite the service we think it is, at least in terms of like success and making money. That's my take. I don't know. But it's weird how much, I mean, if you look at like where the Virtual Console was going in the first few years of the Wii and where it is now, it has taken a big step back. And it's not just the Virtual Console, even across other systems. I mean, after the Virtual Console was catching on, like you saw Xbox Live, like a million different old games get ported to like Xbox Live, you know, Sonic games and Doom and like a variety of old games. And that's kind of gone now, right? I mean, Xbox One and PS4 aren't getting like ports of like Sega games or Super Nintendo games arcade games.
But like PS3 has like or PlayStation, Sony alone has like such a huge backlog of games that like it's always been there. Like they've always had Final Fantasy Tactics and all the Final Fantasy games. Like that alone.
Well, yeah, but that's the same. I mean, Nintendo will always have Mario games. I mean, those are the money makers.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I'm saying like they're not porting that many big games out there because I mean, most of the really big ones have already been ported. I mean, granted, there's a few glaring holes, such as, you know, Heart Gold, Soul Silver. When is that going to be downloadable? Because I want it really badly. Guys, I'm really into Pokemon. I'm not sure if any of you have read any of my stuff or heard me talk ever, but Pokemon Heart Gold, yeah. Soul Silver. Let's get on that. I will pay lots of money to have that with me at all times.
Yeah.
And in 3D.
Yeah, I don't know.
And but having I mean, even, a 3D Pokemon travel with me all the time. And even having shinies more available to me. And I'm done.
Okay. I mean, it was, even with the Sony stuff, though, they still haven't... like, on PS4, you can't play any PS1 classics yet.
I know. Well, I can't believe that. I thought that'd be...
There's also PlayStation Now rolling out, which is built explicitly for that purpose.
Right, which is where more than likely where that's gonna show up. But... I mean, I'm thinking of, like, especially third-party stuff across all these platforms. I feel like you're just not seeing that as much now. The first-party stuff will be there, and, like, the of course, Final Fantasy. The big stuff will be there, just like Nintendo's going to have all its big first-party things.
Are we talking about Sony or Nintendo specifically right now?
All of them. I think across the board, you're seeing... I think across the board, you're seeing a big... like pullback from this sort of retro revival that we were seeing in like 2007 and 2008. I mean, like every week across PSN, Xbox Live, and Virtual Console, you were seeing like a variety of different retro games get released, and that just isn't the case anymore.
Well, Atlas is just supporting everyone now on the digital platforms.
Yeah,
specifically here, because just every few weeks now, it feels like they got a new PS2 classic, whether it be Persona 4 or SMT3 or the Kuzunoa, I think it's pronounced, games.
Wait, is Persona supporting 4 on those... PlayStation 3 yet?
What?
Is Persona 4 on PlayStation 3?
Yes, it is.
What?
It's not Persona 4 Golden, it's the PS2 game.
Yeah.
But you can get it for $10 right now.
What? Yep. I recently was going back for Persona 3. Guys, what is my life? The more I'm talking about video games, the more I'm realizing maybe I don't go out enough.
Well, it's about to be filled with Persona 4.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
We got another question, don't we, Scott? One
we
more.
Do. We do. We have one more. Yes.
Let's do it.
Do we even have... You know, I don't see the person's name on here. I think you originally had it. I think it got cut off. Okay. This is from Peter Stockwell, yeah.
Okay.
He says, what's your favorite game that you didn't like the first time you played it but came to appreciate later in life? Man, that's a tough one. Does anyone have any ideas? I mean, Alex, you saw the question early. Did you think of something?
Yes, I was thinking a couple questions ago about this one, just so I have something locked and loaded. And the best answer I have to this is the Phoenix Wright game. Because I originally played Phoenix Wright 1 using methods back in like 2008. And then I played it. I wasn't like smart enough to understand the challenge of that game. So I ended up using a walkthrough on it a lot, and I didn't get to appreciate it at its fullest. Yeah. And then I played it, I left it alone for a few years, and I was like, ah, that was okay. Now, fast forward to last year, I say to myself, you know what, now I want to give Phoenix Wright the time it deserves. So I buy physical copies of all four of the original Phoenix Wright games, and the Edgeworth Investigations, and I cram through at least the first four main games over a few weeks in a span of 80 hours of gameplay. No walkthrough usage at all, really. And I ended up having one of the best times of my life with this series. Like, it ended up being the type of adventure game made for me. And by the time the fifth game came around, I ended up doing 90 minutes of connectivity discussion with James Jones just about the fifth game in the series.
That's right, yeah.
So, I, like, at the time, I didn't get into it fully. But five or six years later, I'm all in.
Nice. No, I don't know about anything, at least not recently, that I've sort of actively not liked and then got back into. Although maybe, Alex, maybe you'll have your wish and that'll happen with Dark Souls and me. We'll see.
Yeah. My one wish for anything ever in life.
Yeah.
For you to get into Dark Souls.
well, after I recorded last week, with Zach about PC gaming and everything like that, our friend of the show Travis, he's going to send me his old Xbox 360 controller that he uses on his PC because he got an Xbox One One. So I will hook it up, I will reinstall Dark Souls, and I will see if it goes any smoother with a controller versus the keyboard and mouse. So we'll see how that goes. But other than that, I mean, nothing that I, like, actively didn't like, but stuff that I just sort of fell out of at the time and then went back to finish. I mean, it's funny, we already mentioned it, but Persona 4, I was playing on my PlayStation, my backwards-compatible PlayStation 3 for a while, and then, I don't know what happened, I guess just life stuff got in the way, and I completely fell out of it and never finished it. I probably played, like, maybe 20 to 30 hours and enjoyed it. I mean, had fun with it, but just completely fell out of it. And then when I got my Vita, I got Golden on Vita, and, like, completely played through it last winter, and I mean loved it, of course. So there was that. And then I think when I was real young, another game, I mean, I adore it now, but Earthbound, I think, and it might have been a product of age too, but it didn't really click with me right away. I mean, when I got it, I would have been 10 or maybe 11 by that point, and I know I didn't end up beating it for the first time probably until I was like 13 or 14. So I think it just wasn't for me at the time. And then as I got a little older, then I really appreciate it. And now, of course, I adore it. So that's that. Josh, what about you? Do you have something like that?
Yeah, actually, when I was a wee lad, a friend of mine had Final Fantasy Tactics Advance, and I thought it was like freaking stupid. and I just like didn't get it. And then I remember when I was like, I think, God, when did it come out? Like 2000? No, I don't know, man. Whenever, I remember like the year after it came out, that same year, like a few months after I played it, I just was like, I got a little bit of money and Tactics is on sale on like Amazon or something. I'll just pick it up. Like, let's do it. And I got it and I absolutely loved it. Like, I loved Final Fantasy Tactics Advance. Like, that is like one of my like all-time favorite games. Like, that really, I've beaten that game over and over and over again, even though it takes like so many hours to do it. It is just such an amazing game.
You said this is Tactics Advance?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't like it at first. And now I just, like, I bought Tactics Advance 2. If they make another one, I'll buy that. If it's already out and I'm just not aware of it, I'll go out and buy it after I'm done.
Have you played the original Tactics?
I did. I downloaded it on my PS3. And I like the original Tactics now.
Was it after you played Advance?
Yeah.
So how do you compare the two? Which do you like more?
I like Advance more, but it's just because it was a more like fully developed like job system. You know, like, I don't know, like, it had a lot more. I liked Tactics. I really did. I thought it was a really good game now. But it's like, I don't know, Advance was made to be like, you know, you do a job, you put it in your pocket, turn it off, save it, like, come back to it later. But Tactics for the PlayStation, I feel like you really just needed to sit down and, like, play through a chunk of story.
Well, yeah, it's obviously, it is not at all a mobile game. It's funny, I didn't really like Advance, I never beat it, but Final Fantasy Tactics Advance 2 on the DS was, like, totally pulled me in.
Really?
And I really love the original Tactics. Didn't like Advance, but Advance 2, I easily put 100 hours in. Like, I could grab maybe later I'll grab the card. I still have it. I'll throw it in my 3DS and pull up my save file and see how long it is. But I easily crossed the 100-hour mark, which for me, like, never happens anymore. But that game really did suck me in. No, I really like Advance
2. That's what I'm talking about, though. Like, Advance 2, it just basically built on Advance. Like, excuse me, I'm going through puberty. sorry, guys, I'm actually a 14-year-old boy. So I no, but it didn't really add anything new for me, you know. Advance 2, it very much is built on a world that was already like so solidified for me.
Well, what I like about Advance 2 is, if I'm remembering correctly, I feel like the judge system wasn't quite as restrictive.
It wasn't at all.
Yeah, like Advance, you could start a battle and it could just be like, you can't use anything. Have fun.
Yeah, and I'd be like, all right, how am I going to win this one?
I'll throw items at all my enemies, I guess.
Hey, that was so much fun. That was so much fun. Oh, hey, I have, like, you know, 42 ethers or potions. I'm never going to use them. I have a healer. Let's just throw them.
Yeah, and then the next fight, you can't use any healing spells and have to use healing items, and then now you're all out of items.
Which, hey, I don't know. That's my fault for not planning ahead. I'm just not realizing this may have been an abusive relationship.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
That was on me. Me messing up? Oh, man.
But other than the judge system, I enjoy it. And I feel like they refined it a little bit more in Advance, too, and it made it better. Yeah, so.
If they ever come out with another one, I'd be very excited to see where they go from here. Because last time they added in two new races with, like, three jobs apiece. And I was like, all right. I mean, I didn't really use them. I pretty much just stuck to my, like, what they were called, Bangas, right? Is that how you say them out loud? I've only read them.
Which ones?
The ones, the lizard people.
Oh, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I know who you're talking about.
I don't know.
They look like giant lizards.
This is one of those times where you read a word over and over again, and you're like, yeah, that's how it sounds. And then you say it out loud for the first time, and you're like, oh, wait, I might be saying something, like, super offensive.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, so that's what's happening right now. But yeah, I pretty much just had, like, a clan of them and, like, the Vieiras, just basically, like, those two, and that's it. And then, like, I'd be like, who needs humans? Except for ninjas.
Yep.
That's enough to talk about. That's been Final Fantasy Tactics Hour. This is Josh Max.
Signing off. All right. Well, there you go. So there were more questions. We'll get to them next week, because there were some good questions that we didn't get to. If you would like to send us questions, you can do that by sending them to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com, or just tweet them to us. I guess that worked pretty well today. Most of them were tweets. Let's go through and do a Twitter roll call here. Well, first of all, you should follow Nintendo World Report on Twitter. It's Nintendo_NWR. It's a good Twitter account to follow. I'm OK Soda. The letters OK and the word soda. Josh, what about you?
I'm Josh B. Max, but I pretty much just tweet bad jokes.
I feel like there'll be, like, weeks at a time where I don't see you tweeting at all, and then, like, there'll be a day where you're just like, I'm gonna kill it today.
Pretty much.
Yeah, you just, like, you just tweet, like, the most, like, random best stuff. Alex, what about you?
My Twitter is @CULAFIA, Kulafia, Kulafia, however you prefer.
So there you go. Yeah, it's his last name and then A from Alex. There you go.
Yeah.
So yeah, thanks for listening. Send us some more questions and letters and all that good stuff. And we will talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Don't forget, you can send your listener mail questions to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. And if you've got a moment, we'd love it if you would rate and review the show on iTunes. Now stay tuned for a bonus segment on Godzilla featuring Zach and Johnny Metz.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special segment of Connectivity. I'm going to be your host for this one. I'm Jonathan Betts. Hello, I'm on Connectivity. And joining me for this bonus segment is Mr. Zachary Miller.
Hello, hello.
And Zach and I are joining forces today to talk about Godzilla, or probably more appropriately, Zach is going to talk about Godzilla and I'm going to ask him questions. So the format of this will probably be similar to the space Q&A that I do with Scott, and I'll be playing the role of Scott on this one. And we wanted to talk about the biology, the anatomy, the evolution of Godzilla as seen in the new movie. Is that right, Zach?
That is right.
All right. Well, I know very little about biology or anatomy, so I'm going to play the straight man here and sort of cue you up. But Zach, I guess one way I'd like to get started, just because I'm curious how you would respond to this, but obviously most people know that you're an expert on dinosaurs. Is Godzilla a dinosaur?
That is a good question, Johnny. You know, in the old Toho movies, he is a dinosaur. He's a semi-aquatic dinosaur who was revived by the nuclear tests in 1954.
He wasn't created by the nuclear tests?
No. In fact, in one of the later Toho movies, he is a Godzillasaurus, a late surviving dinosaur who survives on an island in Japan, off the coast of Japan, and the nuclear tests mutate him and make him huge and radioactive.
Oh, interesting. Okay. It's
one of the worst Godzilla movies, but that's his canonical origin.
And in the new movie that just came out this summer, I think also it's sort of implied that he is very ancient and has been hibernating underwater.
Yep.
And the nuclear tests of the 50s sort of woke him up. And in particular, I guess the awakening of the Mutos, which are the bad monsters in that movie. I guess those are really what set him off because he detects the radiation somehow.
Yeah, I think he hears them echolocate too.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't real positive on that. They kind of glossed over how he got involved.
Well, why would you think that he would be attracted to radiation?
Well, I think the whole radiation thing is dumb. Honestly, no living animal absorbs radiation as an energy source. Mm-hmm. It kills you. but also it's not really it doesn't have substance. You know, it's not something you metabolize.
Well, there's two different kinds of radiation from my experience in space. There's electromagnetic radiation, which includes things like light and radio waves and microwaves and X-rays and gamma rays. And there's also particulate radiation, which is like alpha particles, beta particles. And that's more like the usually heavy radiation that's being given off by unstable atoms. And as they decay over time, usually they're isotopes, I think, and as they decay over time, they cast off these little bits of matter and energy that we call radiation. Those are right. Generally considered to be the more dangerous of the two. And you know, like I think it's not that much of a stretch to imagine that a creature might be able to absorb that energy somehow. But like they kind of talk about that's what the monsters are doing in this movie, but you don't ever really see them do that, do you?
No, you don't. And like when one of the Mutos gave the other one a like a nuclear bomb or a torpedo or whatever it was, it just held it. And I thought, is it just giving off radiation and you're absorbing it? What's happening right now?
Yeah, does it have to eat it to absorb the energy?
Yeah, exactly. Like the one on Hawaii ate the bombs that were in the submarine, but the other one didn't do anything with them. And are bombs like that radioactive before they're activated?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they contain uranium or plutonium. So yeah, they're radioactive.
Okay.
And they're heavily shielded, so you can be near them. Part of the reason they're shielded is not only to protect, you know, workers who might be around them, but also to protect the different components from each other, because the goal of these nuclear bombs is that, you know, once you trigger them to detonate, you're basically having different materials. I'm not an expert on this stuff at all, but my understanding is basically causing a few different materials to combine and be heated up probably to sort of facilitate some kind of reaction. And then once they do, they release all this stored energy. So they kind of like chemicals that you mix in and cause a rocket to, you know, combust and fire. Nuclear fission is what we do with these. And you're basically causing the stored potential nuclear energy that's within these materials to be released through a very energetic reaction.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I suppose, you know, if
so they contain a lot of energy. I mean, if you're a beast that feeds on energy, then it makes sense you would get that. It's weird because, like, when you think of eating something, you think of turning matter into energy, and I guess these creatures would be more like direct energy absorbers.
Yeah.
I guess plants
absorb sunlight. Yeah. So plants, I guess that could work. Yeah.
Yeah. Or
I just wonder if
some
if
bacteria,
like,
maybe, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Well, there are. Yeah. That I think there might be radioactive.
Of course, plants absorb matter as well, mostly from the air.
And water. Yeah.
And from water. Water is used more as a sort of a sweep fluid to transport minerals through the plant.
Sure.
I don't think plants really absorb water so much as it passes through them like dirt through an earthworm. So plants are actually
like
really good at filtering
system.
Water.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. They don't have their own fluid, so they use water to pass things around.
Yeah. Well, then I wonder if it would be feasible if there's enough radioactive materials being given off at any one time. Could something like Godzilla exist deep in an ocean trench somewhere and survive?
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting idea that a creature could be mutated by energy and then evolve in such a way as to use that energy as food, essentially.
Yeah. Maybe they'll explore that in one of the sequels.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea probably comes from an era back in the 50s when we really didn't know much about radioactivity. If I could take a quick tangent, I'd tell you a funny story.
Do it.
I had a professor back at Auburn University where I got my first couple degrees in aerospace. But back in the 50s, this guy was really old and in the process of retiring. But back in the late 50s, there really wasn't aerospace engineering. That wasn't really a field that existed until the early 60s. With the advent of NASA.
Yeah.
And so back in the late 50s, the coolest like avant-garde engineering field was nuclear engineering. And of course, in the wake of World War II and the atomic bomb, there's a lot of interest in this stuff. A lot of people were scared by it, but there was also a lot of promise. We didn't really understand fallout at the time. In fact, Godzilla was almost a message movie to teach people about fallout and what the dangers of fallout, right? But in the 50s, we didn't really understand fallout very much. It hadn't been studied. It was a sort of unintended consequence of nuclear technology. And my professor said that his first job, which I believe was with the Army Corps of Engineers back in the 50s, was to work on a project where they were going to use atomic bombs to dig canals.
Oh, I read about this.
Yeah, which is really
That's
funny.
Insane.
If you don't understand fallout, it makes perfect sense. They're like giant versions of TNT. So
yeah. You
can dig enormous ruts in the earth with this and cause water to flow through it, except the water will then be poisoned for thousands and thousands of years. The other thing he said is that the Army was at one time developing a nuclear mortar, and they abandoned it when they found out that the blast radius of the shells was actually larger than the arc that the mortar could throw the shell. So the person who launched it would be killed by the blast. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So they obviously never saw Starship Troopers. So anyway, so as a dinosaur, if we assume that Godzilla is a dinosaur, what sticks out to you? But let's presume that he is. What sticks out to you in terms of his morphology? Does he look like other dinosaurs? Does he seem like his design is based on existing dinosaurs, or is it kind of a conglomeration of different characteristics?
Well, I think originally his design was based on a T-Rex crossed with a Stegosaurus. And I think this new movie, the new Godzilla, tries to stay true to that while also being more biologically plausible. He doesn't look necessarily like any particular kind of dinosaur. In fact, his head is not as big as you'd expect. If we assume he's carnivorous, and maybe he's not. If he was a dinosaur,
more on that later.
Yeah, we'd expect his head to be much larger. Like you think of T. Rex or Allosaurus, they have really big heads that are, you know, about as big as their torso.
Hmm.
But Godzilla's got a little head, and I think he's also got four fingers and I think four toes. And all these big scutes and scales along his back that aren't really present in carnivorous dinosaurs. So, you know, he might be a relic of the some extinct crocodilian line. Those animals did, some of them had smaller heads than you'd expect at full size, and they had tons of armor on their backs. So I wouldn't be opposed to him being a stem crocodile.
Now, the large panels that stick out from Godzilla's back, that I would agree they look a lot like a stegosaurus, but if my understanding is correct on stegosaurus, those aren't really armor. They're more for heat control, right? They basically give the animal a lot more surface area from which to sort of radiate heat.
True. That was a leading theory. Now the leading theory is that they're for display. And here's why. Different stegosaurs have different plate configurations and sizes and shapes. And you'd think if it was primarily for heat exchange, they'd kind of figure out the best one and they'd all have it, right?
I guess it would depend on the environment.
That's true.
But I kind of like the idea of them being radiator panels for Godzilla, especially because
he
has this ability to, you know, sort of produce a lot of electrical, presumably electrical, maybe it's nuclear energy, and do this big mouth energy blast.
Right.
But I kind of like the idea of that, like having a lot of byproduct heat that he needs to get rid of somehow.
Yeah, and it radiates off of his glowing spines. I actually that idea a lot.
Those spines do always kind of become active when he's getting ready to do the energy blast, right?
Yeah.
So they do seem associated with each other somehow.
Yeah, I'll bet you're right. That's pretty good.
All right.
I like that idea.
Now, so in the new movie, Godzilla is shown, obviously he's been living underwater for a long time. You see him swimming a lot for like thousands of miles without ever really coming up. Do you think does he have gills that you were able to make out, or do you think he might be more amphibious and like breathing through his skin?
No, he's got gills. You can see him in some of the shots. There is a picture on the internet, one of the press release photos of just Godzilla's upper torso from the side. And if you look up on his neck, you can see like four or five gill plates. And there are a few spots in the movie where you can see him breathe deeply and the gill plates arch and go back down.
Now, dinosaurs have gills?
No tetrapod aside from some salamanders have external gills as adults.
Okay.
Or even juveniles.
Salamanders are amphibious though, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. The amphibious ones are the ones that retain gills in adulthood.
Okay, because they're kind of more like tadpoles when they're young, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was thinking that like, I want to say like almost no modern animals other than fish have gills. It's a very unusual feature. I mean, it's kind of like, animals other than birds don't have feathers. You know, it's like it's very it's adapted very specifically for the kind of environment that they live in. So,
now we all have gills in the embryo, and they close up in tetrapods fairly early. But you know, I can see, you know, if we're talking about a large marine reptile, it's not too far out of your imagination that some lineage retained the gills after birth.
Sure, like an alligator. I mean, alligators don't have gills, but it wouldn't be that weird if they did because they spend a lot of their lives in the water, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not really all that crazy.
It's as crazy as a 350-foot tall giant crocodile.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So I'm curious. I mean, they, you know, Godzilla is sort of billed as the king of all monsters. And I think a lot of the design by the movie makers is meant to reinforce that idea. But, you know, obviously animals evolve, so they aren't designed by diktat like that. You don't give them a slogan and then make the monster look like the slogan. So
right.
Does it make any sense to you that Godzilla could evolve to be that large? I mean, what would drive him to be that large?
Well, there are two things that drive large body size. Generally, competition, intraspecific competition.
And Oreos.
And Oreos. If your prey is getting bigger, you need to get bigger too.
Right. But does Godzilla have prey?
No, apparently he does not have prey. Maybe he used to have prey. Maybe his lineage used to have prey, but not anymore. But, you know, even if that's, I mean, no animal can, it's physically impossible for an animal to even approach the size of Godzilla. It would simultaneously, you know, explode, melt, every cartilage cap in its joints would blow. There have been a lot of studies done on both, you'd be surprised, both the old Godzilla and the Matthew Broderick Godzilla about the feasibility of an animal that large. And the math doesn't work out any which way.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's obviously much bigger than like a blue whale, for instance, but
yeah.
Is there something specific about the size of an animal like the blue whale, which I think is the largest mammal on Earth, largest animal currently. Yeah. I guess there were dinosaurs that were larger than that, but
sure.
Is there a practical limit to how large a dinosaur, for instance, could get?
Well, blue whales are able to get huge because they're underwater and they're not.
Yeah. They're not really supporting their own weight.
Yeah, exactly. But dinosaurs, the biggest dinosaurs got, 40, 50 tons and 150 feet long. Those are the big long-necked dinosaurs. But the reason they were able to get so large, I mean, it's kind of a discussion in paleontology right now is how they got that big. But one way is their bones, their vertebrae were paper thin in places. They had incredibly lightweight, air-filled vertebrae. And they had an avian respiratory system. We can talk about that another time.
Yeah, birds have hollow bones, don't they?
Birds have hollow bones, and they have hollow bones because their lung tissue actually invades the bone. I was telling Scott this. If you get a duck and you tape its beak shut and tape over its nose holes and then cut off its arm, it will breathe through its bone.
Oh, wow.
That's been done.
Don't try this at home, kids.
Don't try this at home, kids. But yeah,
that's really
cool.
Birds
will breathe through their bones.
That's crazy. Wow.
I know, right? And it's one of the reasons they're so lightweight is because their bones are hollow and pneumatic. But sauropods were able to get that big because their bones were hollow and pneumatic, but they also they have very large columnar limbs like an elephant. That's one of the things they did with Godzilla this time. Instead of giving him big, you know, human or bear feet, he has short feet that are barely lower than his lower leg. I don't know if you noticed that.
He doesn't really have ankles.
Yeah, he doesn't really have ankles.
They do look more like elephant feet for sure.
Yeah, and so that reduces stress on your joints. But yeah, there's plenty of reasons sauropods got that big. But it's believed that they are approaching, or they do approach, the absolute size limit for a terrestrial animal.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got distracted for a sec.
No, that's cool. You know, one of the problems you have when you're that big is heat exchange. You're hot all the time because you have so much surface area, and you're also, you know, radiating heat too. But when you're that big, you're also storing a lot of heat and producing a lot of internal heat.
Yeah. I was going to say, it seems like with an animal that large, I mean, most of your metabolic heat is produced in the core of the body. But eventually it needs to escape. So the bigger you are, the longer path the heat has to go from your heart or whatever the center of your metabolic energy production is, has to take a longer path to get out to the outside. So if you think about it, a creature like a human has a relatively large surface area for the total volume, whereas a creature like Godzilla would appear to have relatively less surface area for his huge body mass.
Right.
Which again, it kind of makes me think, you know, these scales that stick out perpendicular from his back might be involved in that. You know, they would have to have like a cardiovascular system running through them in order to transport that heat. But
stegosaur plates have vascular grooves all over their base.
Aha. Uh-huh. So that would support that theory. Okay.
There you
cool.
go.
Now, we talked a little bit about this, but we never see Godzilla eat anything. What do you propose might be his food source?
Aside from radiation.
Right, which is pure energy. I mean, again, if he could convert pure radiation into the energy that he needs to, you know, do things, then the only mass he would need is what's literally needed to like build up and become larger, which at some point, once you reach your maximum size, maybe you don't need to do that anymore.
True. Now, if he was going to eat things, you know, I'd probably see him eating whales. I don't think he needs a lot of firepower just because its mouth is so big. He could crush anything, or he could claw it to death or grab it and squeeze it to death with his giant paws. But he might be bad news for the world's whale population.
That's interesting. I got to say, and I talked about this a little on the Box Office Poison podcast when we reviewed Godzilla, but I found it infuriating in the new movie that Godzilla chases these Muto creatures all over the world. and he seems drawn to them, and he obviously, you know, has some kind of motivation to be assertive over them and to destroy them. But then he just kills them and walks away. And I can't think of any animal in nature that really behaves that way. If those are his prey, if he's seeking them out all over the world and going and hunting them down, and he's not an intelligent creature particularly. I mean, he's an animal. Right. So if he's hunting down and going way out of his way to go hunt these things, it's very strange to me that not only does he not eat them after he kills them, but he doesn't even appear to do some kind of like energy transfer thing, you know, like you could see him like maybe absorbing the energy from them, like Highlander style, you know. And if he's a being that persists on pure energy, then that might be sort of plausible. But to me, it was very odd, the fact that he's almost like this assassin, right? Like he goes out and he kills the monsters and then he just goes back to sleep. And it just doesn't seem like very natural behavior to me.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that until you said it on Bop, and I thought, yeah, that's right. That's really kind of distracting. Like, he just leaves their corpses and walks off into the sunset.
It's weird. Like, why was he here in the first place? I mean, he's not like the protector of humanity. He's probably existed for much longer than humans have been around.
Yeah.
So, and also he just doesn't seem to care about humans at any point in the entire movie.
Nope. Which I liked. I liked that about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the cool thing to me about the movie is that it does have this sort of almost like a nature documentary feel to it at the best moments.
Yeah.
You feel like you're watching animals that you've never seen before, but they're more or less behaving like animals. They're not anthropomorphized. You know, Godzilla isn't doing a dance or some of the ridiculous stuff that he used to do in the Japanese movies. And so for me, when they go to those pains to make him look like a semi-plausible animal and to behave like an animal, when he doesn't, it's very jarring. And that was one of those things that maybe in the moment it didn't quite catch me, but like as I was leaving, I was like, wait, why was he even chasing that thing? He just killed it and walked away.
You know, it's possible that he felt they were impeding on his territory. A lot of animals will kill another animal and not eat it if it feels their territory is being impeded upon. Wolves do it a lot, and so do lions.
So his territory is maybe the entire Pacific Ocean.
Apparently the entire Pacific Ocean and the coastal regions, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got to think, an animal that big's got a big territory.
No, that's fair enough. Yeah, I guess so.
I wonder if there are other Godzillas. That's something I wonder about the movie, because they found that fossilized one underground. So I wonder if there's another one out there somewhere.
Well, I mean, I guess he could be the last in his line, right?
Like Draco.
Yeah, but he must have come from something. So, I mean, we would presume that there was a mommy Godzilla and a daddy Godzilla, and they had a baby Godzilla, either from an egg or – I guess some reptiles do have live birth. So,
oh, a lot of reptiles have live birth, yeah.
Yeah.
And some – although he might be from a parthenogenic line, like whiptail lizards are all female.
Oh, they convert at – they reach some level of maturity, and some of them – convert to male?
Oh no, they're just all female, and they all they lay eggs. This is where they got the idea for the stupid Matthew Broderick Godzilla.
Mm.
Females in this lineage, actually several lineages of this whiptail lizard, they just reach a certain age, and they lay eggs, and all the babies are clones.
Oh, it's asexual reproduction.
Asexual reproduction.
Yeah. Oh, it's weird on such a complex animal, though.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Usually, asexual reproduction is on a cellular level. You know, like a bacteria reproduce that way.
Yeah, or ants and bees do too.
Really? Okay.
Oh yeah,
I didn't know that. Like a worker bee is a clone of the queen.
Basically a clone of the queen. They develop differently based on the new nutrients they are fed as they age, as they grow.
Hmm. Okay.
Oh man, bees and wasps, social insects, are fascinating.
Yeah, sure. But Godzilla definitely does not appear to be social. So
no,
that kind of debunks that theory. And also, I guess I don't really like the idea of Godzilla being a clone of his parent or parents, because this is clearly a creature that's highly evolved. I mean, it has very specialized abilities. Very distinct features. And so it just seems really unlikely that this is a creature that's a product of, you know, mere mutation over how many ever cloning sequences. Oh, sure.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Well, before we wrap up, Zach, I think we're running a little short on time here. But one thing that we should definitely talk about is this energy blast that comes out of Godzilla's mouth. Obviously, this is one of the more science fiction-y elements of the whole Godzilla mythos, and right. I'm glad they kept it in the new movie, because it would have been really kind of disappointing if they hadn't done it, even though maybe it's the most ridiculous aspect of this whole thing, right. But it also is super cool, and everybody loves it.
The whole theater cheered when he did it at the show.
Like, I cheered. I mean, how can you not? Like, it's at least you're going to have this gasp of, oh, okay, there it is, you know.
Right.
And if you'd never seen Godzilla before, I mean, I have to imagine it'd be incredibly exciting to see this happen all of a sudden. But like, you know, as a paleontologist or biologist, how do you feel about this? I mean, you know, we could talk about the physics of whether such a thing is even possible. You know, like, I was thinking there are examples of projectile attack evolutions in nature.
Yeah.
Like the spitting horn toad.
They spit blood out of their eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. And some snakes, I think, spit venom.
Snakes. Yep. And there's that bombardier beetle that spits, acidic, I guess, acid stuff out of its butt.
Oh boy. Well, and there's also the – I'm sure you'll remember the name, but the dinosaur in Jurassic Park, the little one with the neck frill.
Dilophosaurus.
Yeah, do they spit venom like in the movie?
That did not have a neck frill in real life.
Oh.
And was also much larger than it was in the movie. And there's no – you can't – you know, there's no fossil evidence in the skeleton that it was spitting venom.
Hmm.
It would be speculation either way.
So
on Dilophosaurus.
So presumably it's a feature, you know, enabled by the soft tissue that would not be fossilized.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Now there's some, you know, some animals that inject their venom with their teeth. They have a nice, easy to see giant groove down the side of the tooth.
Right. Right.
And no dinosaurs ever been found with that.
Hmm. Okay. No spitting dinosaurs that we know of.
Not that we know of. Nope. It would be cool, though.
Yeah, yeah.
But this fire thing, You know, I really like the excuse they made in Reign of Fire. Did you see Reign of Fire?
I did. It's been a while, but I kind of like that movie, actually.
Yeah, it's not bad. It doesn't have enough dragons, but it's pretty good.
You know what? It's kind of one of the early American roles, I think, for Christian Bale. Although he's playing his Welsh nationality in the movie. But he's almost unrecognizable. It's like a crazy looking face and a huge beard.
He's got a giant Kurt Russell beard.
In that movie, what little I remember of it, and I think I had to play the GameCube game of it also, which was really bad. But
there was a GameCube game?
Yeah, of course there was. Yes. This was back in back when most Blockbuster movies still had video games. Nowadays it's pretty much only Transformers. Some of the kids CG movies, you know, we'll get a video game adaptation, but back in the 90s and early 2000s, pretty much every major release would have some kind of licensed game.
That's true, yeah.
This is back when THQ existed to make all of these.
Right.
But Reign of Fire, the thing I remember the most about it was that there's a lot of discussion of the actual anatomy of these dragons and, you know, and how they did the things that they did. And I remember being sort of surprised and impressed that they went out of their way to try to explain scientifically why these giant lizards would have features like wings and the ability to spit fire. But I don't remember exactly what the explanation was.
So the explanation of the fire spitting was similar to this bombardier beetle. They have a sack of on each side of their mouth of a different chemical. And when they're breathing fire, what they're really doing is kind of spitting out two streams of this chemical that, when they meet, burst into flame.
Sure. Okay.
Kind of like gasoline and, you know, something that causes gasoline to burst into flame.
Like liquid oxygen. Yes.
Like liquid oxygen. Yeah. So they're not really spitting fire. They're spitting these two chemicals. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. That is cool. I mean, the thing with Godzilla, though, is that it appears that he's breathing some kind of plasma.
Right.
So, plasma is there's different ways of making plasma, but typically it's made by electrifying a gas.
Okay.
So, you know, again, if Godzilla is sort of this giant capacitor of energy, it makes sense that he might either have some kind of store of gas within him. You know, maybe he produces a certain kind of gas that's reactive in this way. I think neon is the most typical. Like a neon light that's a plasma bulb. So neon gas is a very good conductor of electricity that you can make a low energy plasma out of. So like maybe he sort of biologically produces one of these, otherwise maybe inert gases and then he uses energy from his stores to electrify that and create this plasma and then sort of project it out like that.
Yeah, maybe.
And that would make sense also that he doesn't use this immediately. He doesn't use it all the time. Like it may be something that it takes him a long time to recharge, both in terms of the whatever the matter is that makes up the plasma as well as the energy to sort of ignite it. Might be something that he can only do every now and then.
Yeah, both times he used it in the movie seemed to be kind of last-ditch efforts.
It seems to take something out of him as well.
Yeah.
Like it seems to take a real effort to do it.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like.
In the old Godzilla movies, they theorized that Godzilla had a plasma gland.
That makes even less sense than my version of it.
It does. You can find some really interesting Japanese, like, visible man diagrams of Godzilla with all of his internal organs and his bizarrely human skeletal structure.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah. They're,
well,
they're
I guess the human skeleton would explain how he moves when he fights.
Yeah, that's true. Although he did, I liked in this movie that he wasn't like, he was never straight up. He was always kind of tipped forward. That was nice.
Yeah, well, I think I know what you mean. Like, it feels like he doesn't stand on his hind legs alone. He has to use his tail to stand up.
Yeah.
And that makes it kind of like a kangaroo, you know, like they don't really stand purely on their legs. They use their tail as support, and that's how they get upright. And I really appreciated how they made him look less human in this movie, because that's a big problem in the whole Japanese, because there is literally a person inside of the suit. And with modern technology, you don't need to do that. And so I think it actually benefits the character and the story a lot to make him look less human and more like an animal.
Yeah, very true.
Well, going forward, we already know there's going to be a sequel, and this can be our wrap-up point. Is there
trilogy, baby.
Oh, really? Jeez.
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything in the next movie that you'd like to see in terms of making Godzilla more believable in a natural sense?
I'd honestly like to see him eating something.
Yeah.
Or like we talked about, at least absorbing some radiation.
Right, right.
And seeing that process. I'd also like to see, if not another Godzilla somewhere, then maybe a fossil of a Godzilla ancestor.
Hmm.
You know, something like that. I'd like him to dig into his evolutionary history a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if they're going to have humans in it at all, at least that would give them something interesting to do.
Yeah, that's true. Put a paleontologist in the movie.
Imagine
they put a paleontologist in the Matthew Broderick bit version, and she got to say Theropoda Allosaurus, which makes no sense.
Yeah, I guess there aren't, other than Jurassic Park, there aren't many paleontologists in the movies.
No.
All right, Zach. Well, thank you very much for doing this. I found it very interesting.
Thank you, sir.
It's fun to talk about these goofy things in a serious and academic way.
I know. It's speculative. Speculative biology and evolution is always real fun.
Excellent, sir. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this segment of Connectivity, and hope you enjoyed it. You can, you can send emails about this to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com or leave a comment in the talkback thread over at our website, nintendoworldreport.com.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Johnny. Bye.